Grade 4 Conference, Lecture 32. This is Norse Mythology, Part 10. As I said earlier, it will be good if you can have three blocks devoted to Norse myths, and even then you may want to, once a week or twice a month, tell an additional story in an extra main. And it's always good to have something ready when the Spanish teacher doesn't show up or when PE is canceled or something like that. Don't just send everybody out for free play or do free drawing, but have some additional narratives ready. So what I'm working with right now is what would be the content of the first block, which is about the creation of the world, of which we've already heard, and a description of the nine realms, and an introduction at least to the gods and some of the names of the more important gods. You can easily spend 2 to 3 weeks on this, and by the third week, you may very well be ready to tell one or two of the main stories, which usually involve three of the gods, in particular Odin, his son Thor, and his blood brother Loki. The second phase of Norse mythology, which could be in a second block, are stories of the adventures of the gods. Here again, Thor, Loki play a huge role in this. Odin tends to withdraw to some extent, though he has some very important tales connected with him as well. And this is where we're going to be seeing the interplay, sometimes amusing, sometimes a bit foreboding, between the Aesir gods and the Jotuns in particular, the working of the dwarves, and sometimes just stories of the interplay of the gods among themselves. And this is the center of fourth grade. This is really the heart of fourth grade. These stories which are so exciting for the boys. And even though it is a very male culture, this Norse culture, we see the central importance of the goddesses as well. So there's a lot for the girls to take delight in, too. And this is the point at which you're starting to think about your grade 4 play. And I would hope that you would want to take a theme from Norse mythology. I've offered as a PDF a suggestion of one that does get performed quite a bit. And to be thinking about which children might be right for which roles. And it's not going to be hard to cast this play. And then the third block, or the end of the second block, if that's all you can have, now we have stories in which shadows are cast over the beautiful world of the Aesir, and in which Loki starts to show another side of his being, or we might say the side that's always been there, now starts to become more and more dominant, a much darker side, a much more destructive side. And this eventually leads to the two great tragedies of Norse mythology, the death of Baldur, which has been the subject of several wonderful Norse plays, and also Ragnarok, the destruction of the Aesir gods, and the end, we might say, for all practical purposes, of Norse mythology. Completely unique that a group of gods come to an end. What does this mean? We'll explore this later on. So let's go on with the picture of the world ash, which is not clearly described how this comes into being. It's just sort of there. After Ymir's body has been utilized to create the physical world and the boundaries of even the cosmos itself. Now we learn that there is a world ash growing. And before I go into too many details about the world ash and its signification, very importantly, at the base of this tree, there are three feminine beings who are called the Norns. And the Norns means speakers, those who can speak. And it also means, oddly enough, those who can pronounce. And just as a thought here, spelling becomes a very, very big issue in grade four. Children begin to separate out into those who can spell almost unerringly and those who have a really rough time of it. And as we'll see, this is not insignificant because this is part of Odin's work to introduce the runes, one of the primal alphabets of ancient peoples. And the Norns are those who can pronounce words. They take us back to a time that Rudolf Steiner describes as Lemuria. And he says that there, one perceiving this ancient time, the third period of Earth evolution, the recapitulation of ancient moon in the Earth, would see a feminine being, and she would be uttering sounds. And as these sounds were uttered, large groups of men would be around her and they would start to move. With every word she spoke, movement would occur. And this is something of the beginning, we could say, of civilization to some extent, that words are spoken, movements occur, and human beings begin to find their way onto the earth and begin to become comfortable within their physical bodies on a very, very primitive level. We might think that Steiner revitalizes this and modernizes it in the creation of the arts of speech formation and eurythmy. Only, of course, because this is the modern world, generally the speech formation will be done by a male, and it will be mostly women moving around on the stage. I'm sure that Steiner had deeper reasons for making all of that happen. So here we have the Norns, the pronouncers. We're also going to come across them when we work with grammar, and we will see why. Their names are Erd, Verdande, and Skuld. So here we have Erd, monosyllabic, Skuld, monosyllabic, and Verdande, three syllables. That's major in Norse names. And Erd is the Norn who spins the thread of life. Verdande gives it a color, she dyes it, and Skuld cuts it. So for every human life, these three Norns oversee that life. One of them spinning it out to how long will it be, that life. Another giving it color, its uniqueness, its personality. We might say the astral touch that brings the human being into movement and activity. And Skuld, as her name implies, just do it eurythmically, cuts that thread and brings about death. So these are three very powerful beings because they are connected with the stream of time, which is very etheric in nature. So here you have these beings who have the inexorable etheric connection to the human being, which determines birth and determines death, with a little bit of an astral coloring going on. And they're going to be come to our help, work with us as we introduce the children to the tenses of verbs. The Norns' names are also translated often as Erd becomes fate, Verdande becomes being, and Skuld necessity. Very interesting picture. Now, as far as the tree itself goes, trees figure very importantly in the structural stories, the creation and the structure of the nine worlds themselves. The first man and first woman are called Ask, which means ash, and Embla, which means alder. So man and woman are themselves created by the gods out of trees, rather than the clay, the earth, which is often given in creation pictures. We have a creation, we might say, on a higher level, something that already has its own etheric body and just needs the astrality of the gods to make it come into being. So here we have again, ask, A-S-K, another word that's come into English. The ash tree, which is in a way the entire world, and which has a wonderful threefold structure. Its branches are very, very high. It really reaches up towards the highest heavens and gives a kind of shelter to everything. And one of its roots digs deeply into Niflheim. Niflheim means land of fog, land of mist. And here we have a great dragon named Nidhogg, who carries away the dead and consumes them, and also ceaselessly gnaws at the roots of Niflheim, at the roots, of the tree Yggdrasil, seeking to eat away at it and destroy it. At the top, in the crown, an eagle and a falcon look over the world and see even beyond what the gods themselves can see. So we have the dragon down below, a very metabolic picture, eating that which has died and eating away at the root. And up above, we have the birds with their sharp eyes in the crown, a kind of sensory picture. So we sort of have the head forces manifested in the birds and the reptilian metabolic forces manifesting in the dragon. This will come back to us as we work with zoology and introduce the children to the various kingdoms of the animals and how that relates to the human being. And we can say also that the dragon forces, as they're presented here, really are an aspect of the astral body. That just as in the eagle and the falcon, the astral body gives us mobility, gives us the ability to be active and live in our sensory nature in the world, the astral body also is tremendously catabolic and is always trying to necessarily destroy that which we eat so that it can become us. Here that's presented as the corpses which the dragon eats. But that would only be twofold. So we also have the squirrel Ratatosk, who jumps up and down the tree every day, going from the eagle down to the dragon and telling the dragon that the eagle's going to come down and peck away at him and kill him, and then conveying messages from the dragon to the eagle. Your days are numbered. Just wait till the dragon gets loose and you're done for. So here we have the kind of middle side, the rhythmic system, the circulatory system of the human being going up and down and back and forth, but in an interesting, amusing, and yet once again foreboding way, promising destruction. So Yggdrasil is a tree that suffers. It groans and it sighs. And it is interesting in these Norse myths, from day one, from the very picture of the way the world is structured, we have a quality of something which is going to bring eventual destructiveness and death into the world. Two more branches burrow out of the tree Yggdrasil. One of them leads into Asgard, the realm of the higher gods, the Aesir. And there's a well called Urd, which is, of course, where the Norns gather as well. And the third route goes into the world of Jotunheim, where the giants live. And there is a very special spring, which is guarded by wise Mimir. And this is a spring that gives insight, that gives knowledge, wisdom to those who drink it. Now, Mimir was one of the Aesir who was given to the Vanir after the great battle, this yin-yang exchange that I mentioned. The Vanir kept his body but cut off his head, and that head then was given back to the Aesir, who in turn put it by this fountain, this spring, where great wisdom would flow. Now, if you are at all familiar with a story heard by the 11th graders in the Waldorf School, the Epic of Parsifal, this may bring to mind the head of the father of the great suffering warrior, who only now exists as a head, and yet is capable of imparting great wisdom. So we see this kind of archetypal picture of a head that exists independently of the body, and that also lives as a very strong symbolic picture of wisdom, of the sacrifice that must be made for the head to carry such great wisdom and insight. We'll go on looking at the other realms and seeing something of their place in the greater picture of Norse mythology.